Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. So we go, as usual, to Philip J. Berg, who started this entire movement before various opportunists came in to try to capitalize on it and promote themselves. Berg is the one fighting the battle of principle and doing it under difficult conditions. So we go to Philadelphia now and hear from Philip J. Berg. Welcome, Phil.
My pleasure. How are you doing today?
Fine, Phil. What's new on the constitutional defense front?
Well, you know, it looks like my issue, I hope not, might become very, very important to everyone in this country if the Democrats shove through this health care bill, because then the impetus is going to be to us, because my position is that he is a imposter. He's a usurper. He's illegally in office, and therefore that everything that he does is illegal, therefore void or voidable. So they're playing all kinds of games in Congress right now. I think it's a total disgrace what's going on, and I'm going to do everything in my power to continue our movement. Now, we're working up to, and you know about it, our march, but I have to talk to you later. We haven't firmed up a date yet because we have to get permits. And,
right.
But we're going to have a birth certificate eligibility march on Washington. And from the initial reaction that I've received from people all around this country, from Michigan, from Indiana, from California, from Arizona, from Florida, even a gentleman called me 2 days ago from Massachusetts. He says, I'm handicapped, but I'm coming. I think this could be turned out to be one of the largest marches ever in Washington, because this issue, if you think about it, I mean, you know, but this issue crosses all political lines. It crosses all racial lines, ethnic lines, and everything, because to me, the reason I'm doing this is there's nothing more important than our U.S. Constitution. And we're in a big danger in this country when we see the, in my opinion, the shenanigans going on, which really is not right. I mean, now they're thinking if they don't have enough votes, they're going to pass this healthcare bill, the medical bill, without voting on it. So,
right, deem and pass.
I'm sorry?
They call it deem and pass, or demon pass, it's sometimes called. They don't vote on the bill. They vote on a rule that said we passed it already, even though they didn't.
Right, and even though they say it has... have done this in the past for, you know, other reasons, you know, other situations. We're talking about something here that has, according to everyone, like 1/6 of the economy. And this is really major. They're saying it was done before, but it was never done on, like, major things like Social Security and Medicare. And no one even knows the true figures on this. I'm just mentioning on this before I get back to my issue, because they're just projection figures. They say how much they're going to save, and there's all kinds of things in here that are forcing people to have insurance. And if you don't, the government's going to really take the money from you, and if not, you're going to jail. I mean,
right?
That's not the United States of America that I know and I grew up with, and it's, I think it's a disgrace what's going on. Now, the reason I'm doing this, people keep saying I'm doing my issue because they keep saying it's a right-wing conspiracy. Well, as you know, I blow that thought process because I'm a lifelong Democrat, and I'm still a Democrat, and I'm appalled. I'm appalled at the games that these people are playing. It's really absurd. And, you know, that's why for all you listeners out there, you have to stick with me. What I'm doing here is I am promoting that we should enforce the U.S. Constitution, and we should enforce the U.S. Constitution the way our founders wrote it, and that is the Constitution for president. You must be 35 years of age, lived in this country 14 years, and been natural born. Well, Obama is not natural born. You know, if he was natural born, we would have seen a valid, legitimate, long-form birth certificate a long time ago. But since then, he spent over $1.6 million, I think it's close to $2 million, fighting my lawsuits and all the other lawsuits out there. You don't spend that kind of money just trying to hide something. The trip he just canceled, he was going to go visit Indonesia. You know, and they talk about, and everyone talks how his name was Barry. Yeah, his name was Barry there. You know why? His name is still Barry. I believe we have the, in his book, he talks about his stepfather, Lolo Satoru, returning to Indonesia before his mother and he. And his name, we have the school record on my website. My website is ObamaCrimes.com. And the art, people say, what crime? I said, how many crimes do I have to tell you that Obama has pulled off? It's crime after crime after crime. But he is a usurper. He's a phony. It's the biggest fraud against the United States of America in over 230 years. And really, people should go to jail on this. I mean, this is really outrageous. And you can see what he's doing. The only reason he wants this bill through is he wants something with his name on it. I mean, sure, there are certain things we need for reform, but not what they're trying to show. No one even knows what's in this bill. No one knows the secrets of things. No one knows what they're going to try to take out in the Senate reconciliation thing. I mean, this is not how you do something major. But they're talking about over in Indonesia. Well, his name, we have the school record. His name is Barry Satoru, and his nationality is Indonesia, and his religion is Islam. If he hasn't legally changed his name since then, everyone, his name is Barry Satoru. So every time he signed to run for president under Barack Hussein Obama, that was fraud. You know, people out there fraud. People go to jail for fraud. And he is a phony. And I have a lawsuit pending in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals under false claims or quitem. I state that Obama is not only not natural born, he's not naturalized, he's an illegal alien. And therefore, his term as a United States Senator was fraudulent. Therefore, the salary and benefits he received, totaling about $1 million, should be returned to the U.S. Treasury. The court below threw us out, but I have raised the point, and I've raised a major issue of what conflict of interest. Right. If in this case there's no conflict of interest, then there's no. We should take that word out of our legal dictionaries, because Eric Holder is the one ultimately making the decision here with his underlings at the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's office. Well, Eric Holder, number one, was on the Obama's senior member of his campaign staff. Number two, he was one of three individuals who helped to, was on a committee to select the vice president and who did nominate and select Vice President Biden. And number three, he was nominated and confirmed as the Attorney General of the United States, which is the highest law enforcement officer who reports to the president. So if that's not a conflict of interest, I don't know what it is, because they're the ones who made the decision to dismiss my case. Because the judge said, believe it or not, the judge said in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals has told the district court justices that they have no input whatsoever on False Claims Act cases or quitem. Now, it's not just for this case. They're saying in all those cases, it's usually used in Medicare or Medicaid fraud cases. But they disagree completely with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, who says the judges should have input. And I submit to all your listeners out there, how can you have a statute which provides for a hearing before a federal judge and the judge to have no input? I mean, it just doesn't even make sense. Even, I'll bet a third grader would agree with that. So we're trying hard on there.
Absolutely, Bill.
But I think that's not the way. I think we're going to have to get the public together. So when the date comes out, I'm going to ask your listeners to really spread the word. I'd like to see 1 million or 2 million people in Washington with a copy of their birth certificate, which we would all hold up at a certain point in time, and demand that Obama prove that he's constitutionally eligible to be president. If not, demand that he resign. And if we get that kind of crowd, which I think we will, because there's something like one-third of the country is located within three or four hours of Washington. So everyone, please do this. Go to ObamaCrimes.com.
And stay with us. ObamaCrimes.com. We thank you, Phil, and we'll be waiting for that date. We're going to save the date as soon as you tell us, and we'll look into this issue of the permit, and we'll see you again next week.
This is Cascadia Public Radio. Thank you.
Bill Berg, people say that once the health bill gets passed, if it does, there's no way to roll it back. This is now a third way to roll it back. You can repeal it, you can have it overturned by the Supreme Court, or you can show that Obama is not legally president and therefore had no business signing it, and you overturn this and basically everything else. If he manages to pass cap and trade, which I sincerely hope he won't, you can roll that back too, and other things that Obama might be doing. But let's return now. We're in the, now in the area of deem and pass. So Pelosi uses the slaughter plan from Louise Slaughter of the House Rules Committee. The House can deem that the Senate bill is passed and then add its own reconciliation to that. Is this legal? Is this constitutional? I think the preponderance of the evidence is that it's not. And certainly politically, this is suicidal, as Berg points out. This is the biggest measure in quite a while. You might say, yes, this was done, something similar was done on the reconciliation for the Bush tax cuts, $1.3 trillion in giveaways. But this is somehow, well, politically, it's become a bigger cause than those ever were. So this is the attempt to overcome the Congress and to overcome the separation of powers, the distinction between the House and the Senate in their respective roles. Remember, dictatorship, in particular fascist or fascist-leaning dictatorships, generally involves two things. They involve other things, too, but let's focus on two. One is to crush the power of the Congress or the Parliament. The legislative branch has to be crushed. The other thing is to crush trade unions. If you're out there busting unions, well, you may be a fascist. You're getting there, at least. And in this case, that's Obama, right? He has completed the crushing of the United Auto Workers. He has forced their members to give up concessions, to take them down to the level of a low-wage southern sweatshop in a right-to-work state owned by foreigners, Japanese or whatever else they are. And he's now in the process of busting the American Federation of Teachers. You saw it. I think Glenn Ford is the only other person that I've seen calling attention to this. That school in Rhode Island, when the mass firings occurred and Obama and Arne Duncan came out and said, way to go, fire those teachers, bust those unions, bring on the charter schools, he's into union busting. So, hey, attacks on Parliament, Congress, and attacks on unions. Looks beginning to smell like fascism in the air. I smell fascism in the air here. So the way that Mussolini responded to a situation where the Parliament wouldn't do what he wanted and didn't give him the majority that he wanted was this thing called the legge truffa. That is the election fraud law. In other words, the institutionalization of a vote fraud in the legal system. So the Fraudulent Elections Act of 1923. It's known as the Acerbo law. Acerbo was the guy who wrote the bill. So it's 1923, and Mussolini brings in a bill into the Italian parliament that says, guess what? From now on, if you are the biggest party in any given election, if you get more votes than anybody else in a given parliamentary election, and if you get more than one quarter of the votes, you immediately get a two-thirds majority. You are given two-thirds of the seats in the parliament. Now, this is more open. He does it from the side of the election and the choice of the deputies, congressmen, directly. In the case of Obama, this is more stealthy, right? It's more duplicitous. Deem and pass, and then reconciliation. We've got basically two dubious procedures, one piled on top of the other. Reconciliation already somewhat dubious, and then the deem and pass to get the reconciliation through. This is the suicide of a parliament, and this is what Kucinich and Lynn Woolsey, of course, the reactionary Republicans, are against it, but they're not against it in any interesting way. The Democratic Party has now completely capitulated to this stuff. And, of course, with Mussolini, the fraudulent election law of 1923 then was put into action in 1924. Mussolini actually did get almost two-thirds of the vote. He got an absolute majority, although not quite two-thirds, but he was given two-thirds as a result of this law. This then led to a bunch of opposition members of the parliament seceding. They said, we're
so fed up with the way you run parliament that we're going to go to a movie theater nearby here and we're going to set up our own parliament. This is the so-called Aventine Parliament. And this, of course, was political suicide by those guys because they were then simply out of it. And they couldn't stop the parliament. They couldn't stop a quorum from being reached. And then in the middle of all this, the leading opposition figure, the socialist member of parliament, Matteotti, was assassinated by people thought to be in league with Mussolini, or certainly followers of Mussolini, whether Mussolini knew about it or not. So that's the relevant historical comparison that you can make. Now, it is indispensable to turn to historical parallels to understand what's going on, because it allows you to see things in the context where you can also see the next steps. There is no question of a mechanistic repetition of many of these things, but you can gain tremendous insights. And that is now this question of ungovernability. In a depression, as we've tried to point out, you reach a point where the pie of available economic goodies is no longer sufficient to satisfy all the existing political and economic factions. You get into a situation of triage, of lifeboat ethics in the ruling elite itself, that Bear Stearns may be saved, but Lehman Brothers is going to be destroyed, right? Washington Mutual is destroyed. Other banks are destroyed so that others might live. Generally, there's the idea that J.P. Morgan Chase and Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and a few others are going to survive because they've got the inside track politically. This then leads to ungovernability, where there is no majority, where things cannot get through. Now, this is thought to be partisan gridlock. Partisan gridlock is not just a state of mind. It is an economic condition where you don't have enough economic concessions to go around, and therefore a compromise is impossible because you can't satisfy the minimum demands for survival of the individual participants. Some of them have to get the axe, and therefore they're going to be against it. Now, in New York State, that was reached last year. Already in 2009, you had a situation where the New York State legislature was paralyzed and turned into a brawl. This was an amazing zoo going on in Albany for a period of months. And now we're at the point in New York State, certainly, where the Obama White House is attacking David Paterson, trying to get him to quit and be replaced by this character, Ravitch, who is an agent of Lazard Frere and Felix Rohatyn, who would become the austerity dictator, simply saying, the legislature is irrelevant. We're going to override them with austerity decrees. We'll be back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. Keep your eyes on tarpley.net from day to day. That's where you find the latest essays. I've got stuff up there about the Robin Hood tax. I've got a call to stop Obamacare and enact Medicare for all at $100 per person per month using a clawback Tobin tax, Wall Street sales tax by ending the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and stopping the bailouts and clawing them back. You could afford Medicare for all. Offer it to anybody who wants it. If you don't want it, take your chances. But a lot of people, anybody with a brain, is going to want it, and make sure it's fully funded with no death boards, as in the Obama version. The historical parallels, where we've gone through two on Mussolini, right? Mussolini's fascist corporate state and Mussolini's election fraud law of 1923-1924, which then ended with Mussolini consolidating a dictatorship. We've also seen that we're approaching ungovernability in an economic political sense. Again, it's not just the partisanship of the mind, but it is the economic disaster that's going on. Some factions get the axe. Some factions are thrown out of the lifeboat. They fight back. They paralyze the legislature. And there you have it. In the current situation, it's back to everybody is getting paralyzed. Everybody's getting dumped overboard except Wall Street. That's the only interest that counts. In New York State last year, in 2009, you reached the point of ungovernability, and it continues now under Patterson, with Rahm Emanuel and the Obama White House attempting to force the governor of New York out. David Patterson should be the victim of a putsch, a coup, like the one we had in Prussia in July of 1932, quite similar, to throw out the existing government and bring in an austerity dictator. And that would be Ravitch. And Ravitch would rule by decree, and he would say, if the legislature doesn't give me the austerity measures I want, if they don't fire enough teachers, fire enough cops, firemen, state workers, if they don't increase taxes, if they don't raise the interest rates on the state bonds to please Wall Street, then I will simply rule by decree. And if I don't rule by decree, there'll be a Big Mac financial board. Here we see the hand of Felix Rohatyn from the 1970s in New York City. I will have the Big Mac make those decrees. Now, we're approaching that point in Washington. Two possibilities. One is that the Obama health care bill will not pass. This would be, in many ways, a good thing. In certain way, a blocked situation is the most that you can hope for, provided that there's some organizing process that's leading towards an alternative capable of providing a way out. However, if Obama's health care bill is simply blocked, we will have reached the point of ungovernability in Washington, D.C. There's also the second possibility, which is that the House will be able to pass the Senate bill with this demon-pass monstrosity, and they'll also pass the reconciliation. But that reconciliation will not pass the Senate in the second round, and that will leave a situation of semi-ungovernability and a complete split between the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats, which has been maturing. In other words, a war between the two houses of the Parliament, in effect, of Congress, that would then be one of the symptoms of ungovernability. Similarly, in the British election, we hope that the Robin Hood forces will win out, whatever they are. The Robin Hood forces may turn out to be a cross-party coalition from Labour Party, Liberal Democrats, and even a few Tories. But what's likely, certainly possible, is the hung parliament. In other words, a situation where no party has the ability to form a majority as a result of this three-way division, Labour, Liberal Democrats, and Tories. Nobody may be able to form a majority because the three groups can't agree among themselves because of this triage principle going on in the background, because the basic demands of the different factions to survive cannot be met, and therefore they will not participate in their own destruction. Now, the reason for this, of course, in the background is the world economic depression, and you've got to understand this. We are in a world economic depression of unprecedented proportions. It is bottomless, and there is no cycle that's ever going to lift you out of it. You get out of it when you change your policies to get out of it, and not before. There is no cycle. There is no mystic process that lifts you out of it. In the Weimar Republic, that is to say, in Germany in the 1920s up to 1933 and the Nazi seizure of power, we are more or less here in the U.S. at the point that was reached in Germany 80 years ago, 30th of March, 1930. This is the fall of the Müller Grand Coalition and the coming of Brüning and his austerity dictatorship. And let me just say a few words about this. We've compared Obama to Mussolini before, and that, I think, that's the face that he deserves. We can also, though, compare him to this faction, this grand coalition in the Weimar Republic that was formed in 1928 and lasted until March of 1930, so almost about 2 years. Which was quite a long time for the Weimar Republic. It was led by Hermann Müller, M-U-L-L-E-R, two dots over the U, U-umlaut, M-U-umlaut, L-L-E-R. This is the Social Democrat, Müller, and he presides over a grand coalition of all sorts of political parties, center to left, but a significant majority. And he engages in an austerity policy. In other words, the left-wing Workers' Party makes itself the vehicle of an austerity policy, and in particular takes upon itself the burden of reorganizing the reparations, that is, the foreign debt
In those days, it was reparations. Today, it's the U.S. debt overhang, the part of the U.S. public debt that is owed to foreigners. We now have the Chinese leaders demanding, like the bondholders that they are, that the U.S. engage in more austerity so that their dollar bonds will be maintained in value. The net effect of the 2 years of Mueller is to discredit the Social Democrats and the trade unions because they don't fight for the living standards of the workers and the middle class. And therefore, they become complicit in austerity. And this is what you see Obama doing. Obama does not fight for the demands of the black community or the trade unions or the middle class in general, right, which is the best way to put it. The middle class and its allies, the middle class and those who would like to join it, are being crushed under Obama by people like Geithner and Summers and Bernanke, who he now got reappointed to a second term. However, at a certain point, Mueller fell. Now, under the U.S. system, you don't fall. But as people said, if Obama loses this health care vote, that will be the functional equivalent of a vote of no confidence and the fall of the Obama government in a parliamentary system. The U.S. system is different in the sense that Obama is also the head of state. He can't fall in that way, not quite that way. And the U.S. system is also designed to produce majorities in the government, even when there's no majority in the population. It's an attempt to create stability. It wants to create a majority in any way that it can, because they had seen other options working. But in effect, we are now approaching with Obama, whether it's now in March of 2010 or whether it's in November of 2010, we're approaching the functional equivalent of the 30th of March, 1930. And I'll just explain what's on the other side. After the fall of Mueller in March of 1930, we get this guy Bruning, B-R-U-2-N-I-N-G. And I guess we're going to have to go through this next week. But this is the guy who essentially rules by decree and imposes austerity in the same way that Ravitch does. And my thesis is that's the Petraeus-Romney ticket. Petraeus plays the role of von Hindenburg. Romney plays the role of Bruning. And they take the U.S. apart, destroy socialism.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
All right, welcome back. This is now our last segment here on World Crisis Radio, and we're talking about this moment where you reach the point of ungovernability as a result of the economic depression, which is destroying the economic pie, and essentially meaning that certain factions are going to get liquidated and dumped and thrown overboard. They're going to get the axe. And this is what paralyzes the political system. And, of course, with Obama, it's the sacrifice of everybody to Wall Street. What the Republicans represent is the small business, petty bourgeoisie, the low-wage southern employers, and other economic factions that say, we are not going to pay for the survival of the insurance companies because that will destroy us. So that is the ungovernability part of it. And whatever you think of these people, they're fighting for survival in the same way that Wall Street is. Obama is basically saying the survival of the insurance companies is a key component of Wall Street, in many ways the basis of the entire Wall Street system. That is worth the dumping of the small business people across the country and the southern low-wage employers. And you can see that's where the resistance is coming from. The point that is parallel to this, comparable to this, in the Weimar Republic, Germany, 1920 to 1933, is this 30th of March, 1930, 80 years ago, an 80-year cycle. Interesting that it happens this way. It doesn't always happen this way, but this time it does. So 80 years. In New York State, we have reached paralysis already, and we're now on the verge of a Bruning-like austerity dictatorship of this guy Ravitch. Remember, when you dump the parliament and you dump the unions, that can be fascism. Watch out. And I think that's where we're headed. So we better mobilize to make sure it doesn't happen. The difference between Miller is that Miller had a majority in the parliament, the Reichstag. He had a majority of the votes. Bruning never did. So how did Bruning rule? Well, President von Hindenburg declared a general state of emergency, and under the Weimar Constitution, he was able to rule by decree. That is to say, Bruning would say, here's my austerity decree number 1, 2, 3, and 4, the so-called Notverordnungen, austerity emergency decrees, emergency austerity decrees. You put these out under your signature, von Hindenburg, and I will be the prime minister, the chancellor, under that. So Bruning never had a majority. He hung on in power from the 30th of March, 1930, until the summer of 1932. I think it's July 1932. Then he falls. By the time he falls, you're about 6 months away from Hitler. And there were two more chancellors, von Papen and Schleicher, but essentially you're on the verge of Hitler. Hitler is at the gates. So by that count, we are approximately 3 years away from a very serious totalitarian development here in the United States. The source of this impetus, I repeat, is the World Economic Depression and its effects on the political system. That doesn't mean economic determinism. It means get the political system going to change the economic policy, and you can escape this. There is no determinism. It's just that if you don't get busy, this is what is likely to happen. So under the austerity dictatorship, von Hindenburg has his gang, his camarilla, of his clique that runs him, and Bruning delivers the austerity decrees. I would say, again, that's Petraeus Romney. Petraeus comes in as the man on horseback. They say, General, what are you going to do about the Depression? He'll say, I'll use the same methods that I used to defeat our enemies in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they'll all swoon, and they'd be like, hope and change. Romney will be the asset stripper and hedge fund hyena that we know, the guy who created Scott Brown, the guy who created the Massachusetts healthcare system, which is the model for what Obama is doing. He will be the austerity dictator. Petraeus trying to float above it if he can. What did Bruning do? Well, balance the budget, cut wages, fire public workers, cut entitlements. The main entitlement in the Weimar Republic was an unemployment insurance system. And unemployment payments, unemployment benefits were cut repeatedly by Bruning, and the Social Democrats did not fight. They didn't go for general strikes. They didn't go for the full range of things that they could have done. Now, here's the thing to remember, though. There was an alternative, and this is a big dispute among German historians, and we'll talk about that in coming broadcasts. But I have pointed out that the way you get out of a depression is not to cut the budget, not austerity, not budget cuts, don't fire public workers, don't lower wages. That makes the depression worse. It also makes your deficit worse. What you've got to do is get control of the central bank, the Federal Reserve in this case, in whole or in part, nationalize it, and force them to cough up 0% credit for production. Now, in the case of Germany, and this is very well documented, in 1930, 31, 32, there were people coming forward with this. Let me just give you a couple of examples. You had a deputy minister, a state secretary in the economics ministry by the name of Schaeffer, who said, we should force the Reichsbank, that is the central bank, the Federal Reserve, we should force the Reichsbank to increase lending by 2.5 billion marks, at that time a significant sum, and get people working on infrastructure. We want to build the autobahns. We want to build the superhighways. We want to build the railroad system, expand the telephone system. Do all these things, increase the capital stock of the nation, increase the productivity of labor. In January 1932, a guy called Wagemann, Ernst Wagemann, written Wage Man. This is the federal, the government statistical office. And they're actually linked to export industries, IG Farben, and we know what they did later, but this was before it. They said 3 billion marks should be put out by the central bank for the purpose of infrastructure and other such projects. March 1932, the labor minister in the Bruning cabinet proposed behind the scenes to Bruning. This is a guy called Stegerwald. Stegerwald said, we need 1.2 billion marks for job creation. So credit creation leads to job creation, and you cut the ground out from under the fascist mass movement, which at that time had become very, very obvious and very, very threatening. Let's give a couple of more. July 1931, German industrialists, represented by a guy called Paul Silverberg, they say this deflationary policy of the central bank, the budget cuts and the budget austerity, the sort of stuff you see with Christie in New Jersey, McDonnell in Virginia, and what the Republicans are demanding, he says, no, we should have 2 billion marks put out for infrastructure. Then the most important one that we've mentioned so far, the trade union group, the ADGB, they have Wojtynski, Tarnow, and Bada in January of 1932. They say 2 billion marks from the Reichsbank for infrastructure and related production. It would not be inflationary because the growth of production would compensate for the creation of additional purchasing power. Quite right. And now, above all, the German Employers Association, the bosses, the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce, December 1931, they want a similar sum in the billions of marks for infrastructure and credit creation, job creation, and economic revival. In other words, a stimulus in real terms, pump priming in terms of the real physical, tangible wealth production. So all of these things were there. Now, Bruning was obviously influenced by the Austrian school. Remember that Ludwig von Mises and Hayek had been writing in the 1920s already. And the idea was, no, don't do anything to interfere with the business cycle. And don't do anything that might cause inflation. And indeed, that was the stupidity of the Social Democrats. They said, essentially a doctrinaire Marxist argument that you can't end the problems of capitalism without getting rid of capitalism, so they refused to support these programs. Anyway, the alternative...